Okay, so I'm Stuart Schoenfeld. I live at 210 Robert Street. My wife is Joan Schoenfeld, and she lives with me. And we've been there since 1973. We had two daughters who were born. No, they weren't born there. Our older daughter was born when we lived on Madison Avenue, and she was born. She was born in July '72, so she must have been 18 months when we moved to Robert Street. And then our younger daughter, Rachel, was born on Robert Street in 1975.
When you look back, do you have any idea? First of all, I want to say thank you very much for agreeing to be interviewed.
Oh, you're welcome. Yeah.
You're on the board of directors of Harvard Village Residents Association, so you're familiar with this project of ours. But thank you very much. Was there anything significant that brought you to Robert Street, choosing this part of the city?
Oh yeah, how long? I'll keep the story short.
You don't.
That's really an important story for us. We moved here from the States, from Cleveland, in 1970, and in that time, the central cities in the U.S. were disaster zones. It was right after there had been riots from city after city. And Toronto was amazing because it was a city with a livable downtown, which was something that we liked. And so we were very interested in looking into what it might be like to live in an older downtown neighborhood. And we had friends of friends, were the only people we knew. And they said, out of the question, you can't live downtown. Nobody lives downtown. If you want a Jewish community, the Jews have all moved away, you know. He took us on a ride up Bathurst Street, beginning at Eglinton Avenue.
That was the south end.
And then headed north. And so we took an apartment at Finch and Bathurst, which actually was not a bad place. Goldfinch Court. It's not a place that I would want to live in now, but it had a lot of young couples, had a lot of children. The setting was back off the road. There was a nice interior park-like area, so that it was green. But it was not really what we wanted. We didn't like the idea of getting into a car and driving if we ran out of milk.
Yeah.
It just was not.
So it was practical in terms of family living.
Even that, it was okay. But after a few months there, we thought maybe we should rethink this and see if we can find out something else, you know, better information. So we had lived in Cleveland, in the Hillel House on the Western Reserve campus, and so we were comfortable with that setting. I said, well, let's go look up the Hillel director at the University of Toronto, and that he'll know what's downtown. So that's what we did. And the Hillel director, we told him our story. He said, you know, you want to move downtown? Here, I'll show you. And he had a little Volkswagen Beetle. He said, get in the car. And he drove us around Harvard Street and down through Kensington Market, and he said, here's a shul, there's a shul, here's Greenspan's Kosher Butcher, here's Tannenbaum's Kosher Poultry, here's the Harvard Bakery, you know, in Kensington Market, there was Lotman's, and there was another Jewish bakery still there, and he said, you know, there's stuff here, if you need to have Jewish facilities, which has always been important to us. Mm-hmm. And I go to synagogue on a regular basis, so it was important for me when I was moving anywhere that there be a synagogue nearby. Mm-hmm. So he said, you know, you have your choice. There's at least six functioning synagogues. So we said, fine. And that looks good. And we looked for a place, and he said, if you're looking for a place, oh, by the way, I'm moving out. I'm going to medical school. He was a Hillel rabbi. He decided to go to medical school. I'm going to medical school. And my landlord is the kind of landlord who doesn't like to advertise. He likes his tenants to come by word of mouth. So come and see my place if you like it. Well, talk to the landlord. We saw his place. He was on Madison Avenue. He had the full second floor of a very large house. So it was a large, perfectly adequate space for two people, and then for our daughter. We were very happy there. It had fireplaces, window seats, lots of lights. It was very pleasant. But we began noticing, after living there for a year or two, that housing prices in Toronto were going up. And my smart wife said to me, "You better move, buy a house now, or else we'll be priced out of the market." Because we were then, we were not wealthy then.
As wealthy as you are today, Stuart.
Well, buying a house, any kind of house, even at a relatively low price, was a stretch. But we began to look, and Joan found the house on Robert Street. And so we purchased that house and moved there in '73, December '73. I was not all that happy. The house was a wreck.
Oh.
It was. And if we bought it 6 months before, we could have gotten it for 75% of the price. Like in 6 months, it had gone up, in value.
So Joan was right in terms of prices getting higher.
That was, the inflation in real estate was clearly happening then. So the house had been partially redone. So some of the things that make the interesting character of the house had been taken out, but not enough to destroy the house completely. But the old kitchen was taken out, and a new kitchen was put in, which was not very nice, but it was functional. It was not very nice. And the person who had done the renovations had sold it to a doctor, and the doctor had just bought it for an investment and was like living there while he was in residency. So he was basically sleeping there. And he was married. His wife was there. I think his wife was a nurse. But they were just never home. It was basically for them a place to sleep while their Mac account went up because the value of the house went up. And then they were ready to move, and so the house was on the market. So they sold it like within 6 months after they bought it.
But they didn't take much.
For a nice profit. But it was, it was kind of a neglected,
yeah.
It was early 70s, so you can imagine the color schemes. Purple and orange and, So we saw the potential in the house, and we really didn't know how the neighborhood was going to evolve, but
let me interrupt,
we took
because
that risk. Yeah.
What? Okay. So you did answer my question.
Yeah.
What brought you here?
Yeah.
What was the neighborhood like in 1973?
When we moved in, our neighbors to the north were Italian, who had a garden in their backyard. And one of the things we had to deal with was the manure that he used to spread on his backyard in the spring in order to encourage his tomatoes.
Oh.
The neighbors to the south were Portuguese. Mm-hmm. They did not have a garden. Their space, they didn't have actually a garden spot in the back. The neighbors were nice. There were nothing to complain about, but they were not people that we would, over time we would, have good relations with, but not be friends with.
Did that represent the neighborhood?
Well, I'm thinking.
Yeah.
There were rooming houses up and down both sides of the block, and we were young enough in age and lifestyle to the largely students and graduate students who were living in the rooming houses that we were not put out by the rooming houses.
You're saying they, now they might have a different attitude.
Well, also I think that the attitude towards living in a rooming house is different. The people, the kids in that generation were a little more sedate and a little more reined in. Mm-hmm. You know, we get the sense now that for a lot of the kids who were in the rooming houses, that it's like, you know, I'm free of my parents, I'm going to go wild, you know. And it's really fairly, you know, you get an undisciplined element. There wasn't any sense that the people in the rooming houses were undisciplined and not nice people.
So it's not only that you were younger at that time, but they were different.
Times were different. Yeah. And there were a couple of other young families who were moved in on the street. So it was already, you could see, the gentrification starting. Mm-hmm. And a number of houses had been redone. But it was mixed, which was also fine with us. We didn't want to live in... And one of the reasons that we didn't want to live in the suburbs, we didn't want to live on the street where everybody was the same cohort, yeah, with the same kids, going to the same schools, and living the same lives. And
So you did want some kind of diversity.
Absolutely, yeah.
But it was clear to you, too, that which of the people in the neighborhood you would become closer with and which you would just enjoy nice... neighborly relationships.
Yeah. Well, we're easy to get along with. We're happy with all our neighbors of whatever kind. But you know, you have people who are that you relate to more than so it wasn't really a sense that we felt uncomfortable with any of the neighbors. But there was also a sense that we weren't sure whether this would be the community for us. As I said, I'm used to going to synagogue on Saturday mornings. I grew up that way. I have a lot of nice associations with that. It's a good time of the week for me. And so I need not just a synagogue, but I need to have a synagogue where that has the right kind of atmosphere. And it wasn't clear that the ones that were downtown were actually going to survive. When we first moved in, when we moved into Madison Avenue and I started to get the synagogues here, I remember going into the First New River congregation.
It was there. Do you know when it opened?
Oh, it's been there since 1938, 1940.
Okay. So you tried that one.
Yeah. There were two things that I noticed. First, there were a bare handful of other young couples who, one was a professor at the University of Toronto who just taken the job and moved to the neighborhood, and a couple of graduate students. And so that was a sense that there were people who had the same interest in maintaining the institution, mm-hmm, and that there was some possibility that you could build something there. But aside from that handful of people, everybody else was 30 years older than me.
Mm. That's a lot. They're at a totally different stage of life.
Well, they're also... Yiddish-speaking immigrants whose English was not very good.
Oh, another huge difference.
But they were very interesting, and it was more comfortable for me. I'm the shoulder in the family. It was an Orthodox congregation, and men went, and a few women, but it was. Everybody who'd been left behind when their synagogues left, actually the people who were members who were attending the synagogue at that time, were not members. Because there used to be dozens of synagogues down here, and they moved away one by one, but not all their members moved away. So the ones who were left from the synagogues who moved away went to the synagogues that were still
that was
here.
So the stragglers all
So the stragglers all congregated at the Nerivor.
But they didn't join.
And of those who were regular tenders, there were two members of the congregation. One was the president, and one was the gabbai. And they were both very nice guys. I don't know whether you know, there's also a history project at the synagogue.
No, I don't know.
Okay, so when you know, that's a whole side thing we should talk about after the interview.
Good.
About how these things connect. Because the synagogue was founded in 1914 on Huron Street, and then moved up here in 1930, so it's approaching its 100th anniversary.
Okay, so we'll talk about
that. So they're planning something, a retrospective, mm-hmm. to celebrate the 100th anniversary. So the president and the gabbai lived in the neighborhood, and everybody else, you know, was the word looking at about 35 men who would come on a regular basis. Everybody else who were members of other congregations had moved away. So I remember one day there was a visitor from out of town, not that I knew personally, but he once showed up, and we were walking together after shul, and I told him, you know, where I lived, and he said, you know, why are you living here? You know, he said, you know, in 5 years, 10 years, you know, the shul will be gone. And that was 1970 something, and now it's 2012, and so he was wrong.
Oh, was he ever wrong?
And, right.
And I mean, you know, I go there sometimes. It's thriving.
Yeah, yeah. So a lot of my story of the neighborhood is how I got pulled into that congregation and recruited other people, and we, you know, made it into a place that has survived. So that's
you, one of the things, you came because there were some shuls in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
Slightly.
And we tried out, I tried out others. Because it wasn't clear, there was incipient gentrification, younger people whose jobs were downtown, who were university educated and didn't want to leave the downtown area, and so a number of the synagogues, had people kind of looking and feeling them out. And some places thrived and some places didn't. And eventually, the Nerivor became the place that was kind of the address for the next wave of Jewish life downtown.
Wow.
But it wasn't clear whether that was going to be the place. There were some other places could have done it, but they didn't.
Well, it speaks for itself when you see what's happening there now.
Yeah.
You know, now we're on the topic of Jewish.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering whether you might talk a little bit about your wife Joan's school.
Oh, sure.
Okay, if you'll just introduce what the school is and what.
There's a backstory here.
Okay.
Also about the neighborhood. We hadn't been here very long until, I'm trying to think of what the contact was. Maybe it was even door to door. We had a contact from the Jewish Family and Child Service. The Jewish Family and Child Service had opened up a branch inside the Bloor JCC. They officially called it the South Branch.
The South Branch.
And they had a client list downtown who were largely poor, elderly, and isolated Jews. And so rather than have their social workers work out of an office, half an hour away, they rented space so their social workers could serve this clientele. So when they opened up that office, the director of that office, and I think I'm remembering this right, went door to door, or assigned her staff to go door to door, looking for mezuzahs.
Okay.
And why?
Yeah.
She said, we're new in the neighborhood, we're serving an elderly, isolated clientele, by and large, but we're also aware that there's other things happening. So we want to So we feel like if we're going to establish ourselves here as a social service agency, we need to know the community. Mm-hmm. So we want to convene a focus group of Jewish families in the neighborhood and just see how they can relate to us. So they you know, went knocking door to door. They showed up on our doorstep. Mm-hmm. So this is, you know, it's one of the, it doesn't happen, you know, in the suburbs, right? In the city, you know, the blocks are small enough. You can go door to door and knock, right? So they showed up on our doorsteps, and they explained what they were, and I said, that sounds good to us. We'll be happy to attend, you know, the meeting you're setting up. And when we met a network of people there, well, there wasn't a network yet; it was a bunch of people. The question that was in our minds and in the minds of some others was that now that we have children, we need a school for our kids.
There were other families who felt the same way.
Jewish families, yes. Uh-huh. So the parents said to each other, you know, let's make a parent co-op, and design something. I'm trying to remember exactly what year this happened in. I don't remember exactly what year. It's more than 30 years ago. But in any case, Joan, who's very good organizationally, became the central person in that group. And when they decided to go from planning after a year of planning to actually open a school, it was a parent board, and she was chairman of the board. They announced openings and said, you know, that they could have three classes of 15 kids each, and they were immediately fully subscribed with a waiting list.
Now, this was a Sunday school? What was this?
It began as a Sunday school.
Okay.
With plans to have an additional hour of Hebrew school in the middle of the week when the kids were older.
And was Joan an educator, or she just...
She's a trained teacher.
She is a teacher. Oh, okay.
And she subsequently has her master's degree in educational administration from Boise. Uh-huh. So that was a part of...
But she just rose to the top right away in that
the
group
first,
of people.
The first year the school was in existence, she was chairman of the board. It was clear since that the school was oversubscribed that there was a lot of work to do, and that the school had to grow, and so she went from volunteer to staff.
And it was clear that there was a real interest.
So the board hired her as principal, uh-huh, uh-huh, and then she subsequently grew the school.
So that would have been around 1975.
No, would have been later than that, mm-hmm, or also around 79.
So that's a lot of years ago.
Yeah.
So what didn't exist?
To get the story of the school better to talk to her directly, because mm-hmm, she'll remember this more accurately than I will.
So you came into the neighborhood, there were synagogues here, mm-hmm, you found the Jewish community, and then Joan created the school.
Well, she and a bunch of other parents. The school is downtown wide. There was never a large cluster of kids within walking distance of the JCC. But the next closest school was, you know, Holy Blossom Temple. And for a variety, and there were issues not only of distance, but other kinds of issues that made people not interested in sending their kids to the Sunday school there.
Okay.
So we had parents from the Danforth, from Rosedale, from the Annex, from our neighborhood, from further west and from as far west as Hyde Park.
And they all came to Bloor and Spadina, yeah, to the Sunday school and, plus afternoon school.
And another important part of this story, mm-hmm, is the role of the JCC. At that time, the JCC in the early 1960s, I don't know exactly the date, opened up its brand new building, which has since been destroyed. Literally, you know, they're planning to build something else there. Had opened up their brand new building, and the JCC was debating what to do with the old building at Bloor and Spadina, and there was a rump of people at Bloor and Spadina who said, you know, we really like this building. You know, it's convenient to us. We have our memories here. We want to keep this building.
And this is 1969 you're talking about.
This was when we moved in. This group was the. What happened was the JCC had moved, and they'd left this rump of guys, uh-huh, you know, maintain the JCC down here because they were so strongly committed to it.
Right.
But the guys who were running it down here were worried. They said, "We're going to be, you know, we're going to get old, and what's going to happen to the building?" Right? Things happen, you know. We're not so young anymore already, and you know, we'll lose energy, and what will be? So, when Joan came to them, or the Joan on behalf of the Downtown Jewish Community School came to them and said, you know, we need space for a school, and we'd rather not go into a public school after hours, which was then an option. We'd rather, mm-hmm, you know, use the JCC. They were very happy to see her.
Good. So they were happy to have some young blood come, yeah, while they could still maintain their Y.
The director then was Erwin Sorin.
I remember Erwin.
Okay, so Erwin, you know, Erwin, if I recall correctly, was not a trained administrator. He was a member who felt deeply about, mm-hmm, the poor JCC, and that was the culture then, that they didn't have. They weren't professional, and they had maybe one trained professional who ran was at the top of the whole outfit, but the JCC wasn't about to hire somebody a professional salary to run the Bloor building, so they could hire Erwin, you know, because he cared about it.
He cared about it, and he wouldn't charge a lot, yeah, for his services.
Yeah, and so he took it to the JCC board, and the JCC board was very welcoming to provide a low-cost home for the school when it was first getting started.
It sounds to me as if they were thinking, we're not going to get turfed out, we're not going to be the Altacockers necessarily, yeah, and we'll bring the young blood in and, yeah, keep this place vital.
Yes, that's what Joan said. He said to her, because I wasn't in the room, was he said, no, you're the future of the building.
So it was a happy marriage, so to speak. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I get, you know, it's interesting. I hadn't thought I would get emotional about it, but it was.
Yeah. Well, I'm grateful to Joan.
Yeah. It was one of those moments where somebody saw an opportunity and took it, you know. So what was in Erwin Sorin's mind was, they'll get used to coming into the building. So it won't just be that they'll have their school here, but once they're here, they'll become members, and then it'll be their place.
He was right.
Yeah.
He had a vision, and yeah, he was right on. And yeah, Joan, luckily for the timing, was good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's a wonderful story.
Yeah.
So you've been in this neighborhood for many years, right, and you're talking about the shul and mm-hmm, the day school. What changes have you seen in the neighborhood in terms of the population of the neighborhood?
Oh, the Italians and the Portuguese have, by and large, you know, Your children have not stayed here. We have a few families who are still here, but I don't think their children are here. So that's transitioning.
Are some of the old timers still here, or have they died or moved out, or what?
We have an Italian family across the street that was here when we moved in, so they're still there. I don't know for how long.
Do they speak English? I want to meet them.
The husband died about 5 years ago, and the wife has been in deep mourning ever since. You know, she's in deep mourning, and she has health issues. Mm. You know, it's one of those stories, you know. Yeah. And her son and daughter, who grew up in the house, I think come to visit, but I see no sign that they live there.
I have a similar observation, yeah, that a lot of those young people were happy to move into newer homes, bigger homes.
Yeah. It's not what's happening for their reference group. What else has happened? Fewer rooming houses. You know, on our block, a number of the rooming houses were converted into either duplexes or single family homes. Are there any rooming houses left? I don't think there are, actually. I think we're now, I don't want to say rooming house free because that's pejorative, but we now no longer have rooming houses on our block. The population is still mixed, and it's still largely mixed in the way in which it was when we moved in. Let me think about this. I'm thinking about our immediate neighbors. For sure, it's a better educated group. Mm-hmm. We have professors or retired professors. They don't dominate the block, but they're clearly present. Our block is tending in the past few years to become more upscale. It feels like a tipping point has been passed when I look at the very recent people moving in. The very recent people moving in are people with money and people who renovate to a high standard.
Well, I think also the prices are so high that they're buying those homes at high prices and then renovating.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that it decreases as you move towards Bathurst, like Lippincott, mm-hmm, and Borden perhaps have fewer of these homes. Yeah. It's moving west, but slowly. Yeah. But I think that Robert Street and Major,
yeah,
Brunswick, and a little less as you get.
And by accident, our section of Robert Street, I say by accident for us, mm-hmm, our section of Robert Street is a very nice micro-environment. We're far enough away from Bloor Street, we don't get the Bloor Street noise, we don't get the problems that people have with the Brunswick House. We're far enough away from college, we don't get the problems from that end.
Yeah. That describes where I live too.
Yeah. We have one bar that opened up that's starting to be a nuisance, but, mm-hmm, it's only so far only one bar. With the Harvard Street strip between Spadina and Brunswick has undergone major transformations since we moved in. None of those fancy restaurants were there when we moved in, and now it's a there's half a dozen really, really good restaurants that people come from all over the city to go to.
And those will never be noisy. It's the bars that are noisy. So no. Just that place on the corner of Harvard and Robert. But the rest will never be noisy.
Right. But that is a change. I mean, the where Macy's is now was Peretta's Pizza. And it was a local pizza shop.
Okay, you're moving us along, and I would love you to continue talking about Harvard Street and the changes that you have lived through.
Right. Along Harvard Street, the other thing that's different about the neighborhood is the tree cover. You took the picture of the tree.
Yes.
So that's when... When we moved in, there were some of the horse chestnuts that are still there, but some had died off and been cut down. And our end of the block was a vacant of trees. There were no trees in the front yard. And I don't remember who told us, but someone explained to us, you know, your property is only partly your property. About a quarter to a third of your front yard is road allowance that belongs to the city. And the city has a forestry department. The forestry department will plant trees on city property. So if you would like a tree in front of your house, call up the forestry department, and this is, you know, and they have a list. They keep a list of people who want trees planted. So we wanted to have a tree in front of our house. We wanted the shade, and we wanted the feel of a tree-lined street. We got on the list, and mid-70s, so we were being patriotic. We asked for a red maple. Not knowing the problems that you have with red maples in your front yard. But they're lovely trees, but you can't grow grass under them. Mm-hmm. So anyway, we asked for red maple. And then we encouraged our neighbors to make the same requests. So there were three trees planted in front of three adjoining houses within a year or two of each other. And those trees have matured and they've changed. A streetscape at our end of the street. You know, there's a wonderful tree canopy where we are now. It provides shade, it provides shelter from the wind. It cools in the summer, keeps, you know. So we're very happy to have been part of that greening. I remember when we asked about this, I might have asked Ron Cantor who to call. Ron Cantor was then at our city councilor. And Ron said that, like he said, I get calls like this all the time, but they flip depending upon where you are. The Italian and the Portuguese people call and say, can you cut down the trees so I can plant a garden? And the people who are gentrifying say, can you come plant trees because we want the shade?
Yes. Well, and as you mentioned, I took a picture of your tree when I was very young, and I'm going to your house. I'm going to take a picture of it 30 years later.
Yeah.
How many years later? 30.
Well, more than that. It'd be 35.
Okay. Yeah. So I'm going to take a picture of it.
It's full of mature. You actually won't be able to get a good picture of the house because the tree is so lush that by the end of the summer, after the leaves have grown full out, you don't see very much house behind it.
Well, you know, you're having this conversation with somebody who loves trees. Mm-hmm. I just love the trees, everything that they offer, and the silhouette against the sky.
Yes.
So I'm looking forward to having the comparison of the tree then and the tree as a... Is it still growing, do you think?
No, trees grow.
Yeah.
They grow until they die. Yeah. They have life cycles.
Yeah.
So speaking of changes, there was also a significant backyard change.
Oh, please tell me.
Norman Track lives up the block. Norman is a doctor.
Lives up now or...
Now. But he has lived there, I think, almost as long as we've lived there. When we first moved in, our backyard opened up onto a lane which was deeply rotted and neglected. And the deed for the property included our part of the lane.
So the lane belonged to you?
The lanes in the back were all private property owned by the homeowners. And it was the worst lane in the neighborhood. It was in terrible condition.
And
it was, you know, bumpy and there were rocks. And
so
rocks
not paved?
No.
Okay.
So Norman did a really good thing. He got a petition together. He went up and down the block and he said, would you deed your portion of the lane to the city? And if you do this, then the city becomes the city's responsibility. And the city will install a proper roadway back in the lane. So that's how we got our lane improved.
But you're also saying that everybody agreed to do it.
Yes. On both sides, he had to get all of Robert and all of Major to agree to give up their part of the lane.
Did anybody resist?
Not that I know of. We just signed the petition, you know, or whatever legal document it was saying. And then... you know, then the lane got fixed, but it really was a difficult lane to live with. We didn't park in the back, but the only odd times when we did have to pull our car into the backyard, it was just awful. I mean, you know, it was like driving down a neglected country lane where you never knew what was going to be in the roadway ahead of you.
And you'd get stuck. So what year was it actually paved, approximately?
It's been paved for decades now. It's been paved for maybe 25 years now.
Did anybody put garages back there, or is there not enough room for that?
There are a couple of garages.
Uh-huh.
They're not garages you can pull into. They're garages you have to park sideways. But people did use it for parking, so they typically have their back fence, then a parking space, and then the laneway. So they didn't give up the parking space; they didn't give up the laneway part.
Did the lane begin to be used in a different way after it was paved? How was it used?
The children would play out there. So we have, we have. One of the nice things that we've seen is that we have seen that other people have moved in to raise kids, and so there have always been kids on the block, which in an older neighborhood you never know about, and especially, you know, a gentrifying neighborhood where it's often, you know, people who don't have children or don't have children yet. So our street has maintained kind of a family-friendly atmosphere. So even amongst the new people who move in, I met one of the new neighbors up the block who just moved in over the summer, and I met the son, little, you know, guy about 6 years old.
So
I don't know if there are any other kids, but there is that sense that there are always kids on the block.
Yeah.
Which means one of the nice things about the street, as the street evolved, was it became a really interesting street for trick-or-treating.
Oh, okay. Let's go there.
Yeah, it is. As the little kids got to be a little older and they started going costumes, you know, it's the kind of neighborhood where, because the houses are so close together, it's really easy to go trick or treating, and the parents don't have to worry so much about security. Young kids, you know, they can just stand on the sidewalk and send the toddlers up to ring your doorbell. So just, you know, by itself, without kind of any planning, you know, became a thing for kids in the neighborhood to do, you know, to dress up and make a big deal out of trick-or-treating. Some of the neighbors, you know, do more things with their front yard on Halloween to make it more you know, to make it more lively and to add to the atmosphere. And of course, it always helps that when, that at some point on Halloween Eve, Gus will parade through with his bagpipe.
Oh, right.
Right. So, so that's been changed. We've seen that kind of culture. As the kids have gotten older, will they keep that? I don't know. The ones, our immediate neighbors in the north and south who have been active in this, the youngest kids are now 10, 12. They may have gotten to the point where it's no longer cool to do this. I don't know. But we'll see what the new
maybe
kids.
It's no longer cool to wear a costume, but going and getting candy will always be cool.
I don't know.
Yeah.
The other really important change in the neighborhood is Richard Gilbert's accomplishment, which is the street maze. Mm-hmm. When we first moved in, we did not have a street maze. The commuters would use the one-way streets to go up from college to Bloor as a shortcut. And that was not so good.
I'll bet it was a quick shortcut. Yeah. I mean, really shoot through and stop briefly at the stop signs.
We were very happy to see the street maze come in, and we saw the volume of traffic on the street decrease, which made the street much more pleasant.
Yeah.
The other important change along those lines was the introduction of permit parking. When we moved in, there was not permit parking on the street. Then I used to spend more time at the office than I spend now, because my teaching schedule was different, so I just had to be on campus much more. And also with kids in the house, it was harder for me to work at home. So I work at home now more.
Mm-hmm.
Then when we first moved in, I would be almost every day coming back at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, 6 o'clock, looking for a place to park, and it was awful. One of the not-so-nice memories I have is coming back, knowing that the kids were little and they needed something, you know, things were going on in the house that needed attention. And I would have to circle the block and circle the block and circle the block, looking for a place to park.
And take another 10 or 15 minutes till you could park your
car. That was really tension provoking.
So
and when permit parking, who introduced permit parking?
Who worked hard to make that? It had to be another petition.
I don't know. We were probably asked at some point whether we wanted it. And so we had to agree to have it. It might have been an initiative from that came out of City Hall, where they polled the neighborhood, rather than something. Or I just don't know. All I know is that ever since we had permit parking, I've willingly paid whatever the city asks me to have my permit to park on the street, knowing that. That on those days when I do use the car, that I don't have to worry about being able to park when I come home.
Well,
and it used to be just a regular nightmare.
Yeah. Well, by the time I lived on Robert Street, south of Harvard, the permit parking was already in place.
Mm-hmm.
Because, of course, I know that the restaurant, people using the restaurants, mm-hmm. or U of T people wanted those spots on Robert Street. So I understand why it was impossible.
For us, it was University of Toronto.
Yeah.
Robert's only one block in from Spadina. And so students, you know, would drive down in the morning and park and then stay there and then, you know.
And 16 hours later remove their car.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, you've only got how many spaces on the street, limited number of spaces. So you only need, you know, half a dozen students or a dozen students to do that. And there's no parking for anybody else.
But one of the things you clearly were talking about when you talked about Halloween and it was such a nice atmosphere, you're talking about a sense of community that was happening with a variety of kinds of people and ages. Mm-hmm. But certainly you were happy to have the young people there with the young families. Yeah. We talked about the lanes. I'm wondering whether you might talk for a few minutes. We touched briefly on it, but how people use their back gardens, mm-hmm. or what they had back there, and also front porches.
On our block, the front porches aren't heavily used. Uh-huh. I mentioned to you the older Italian woman, the widow.
Yes.
She sits on her front porch a lot. Uh-huh. And when her husband was alive, he sat on the front porch with her. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, it's not, our block is not a block of front porch hanger-outers.
I think your porches are a bit smaller than some of the others on, like, say, south of you.
Some of them are larger, but most of them are fairly small.
I'm sorry, and you said you do sometimes?
I do sometimes, yeah. And when I do, I notice, you know, there's not anybody else. The backyards, I'll start with our backyard, that our house had been partially renovated when we moved in. And when we moved in, the backyard had been used as landfill, and the plasters, the renovations had included, you know, taking the plaster walls off, because a lot of the plaster cracked. So rather than repairing the plaster, which was more expensive, people had taken the plaster out and put up drywall, mm-hmm. and they just threw the plaster out into the backyard, and that was their backyard paving.
So that's when you bought it, you had plaster.
There was the remnants of that that had not been cleared away. We made a garden back there over the years. The first, when we needed it for parking before the permanent parking, we had a concrete pad, and eventually we took up the concrete pad, had it just pulled out, and put down paving bricks, and they're much nicer because it feels like a garden, and they also, in terms of water. Water runoff, you know, the paving bricks absorb the water in the concrete, the water just flows down. So wherever it flows, it's flowing towards your house, as it tended to do. That was not a good thing. So we've put in paving bricks, we've heavily planted in the back. The back is a half a dozen different kinds of plants, all crowding each other out. So it's now in Israel, it's probably overcrowded now. It needs to be cut back. Our neighbors to the south use their backyard for parking. Our neighbor to the north that house was rented for a long time, but in the process of renovating for this was part of the transition that was renovated to go from a rooming house to a rental house for a single family, and it was used as kind of we had a family there for about 3 years, who was a bank executive, you know, a young banker, who was one assigned in Toronto, and he knew he wasn't going to live in Toronto, but he was just going to be there, passing through.
But he rented it?
So he rented for 3 years. So it was that kind of rental. It was renovated. So they did a very nice backyard renovation for that transition. And then the house was subsequently sold, and now it's an owner. Someone who lives in a smaller house up the street.
This bigger house.
That, like the neighborhood. He actually bought the house. The story is that our neighbor to the north bought the house with the intent as a rental property. His wife came to look at it and said, I like this house. So they moved. And their children live in their house. So that's, which is also, it's nice, kind of nice to see.
That family clearly likes Robert Street.
Yeah. That the kids like their parents enough, and the parents have a good enough relationship with their kids, they can sell them their house, right? So, so in terms of other backyard uses, they tend to be sitting gardens in the back, a few of them are used as parking pads. Maybe a quarter of them used as part of the backyard used as parking pads. And because they're short backyards, there's not really room for anything else. Mm-hmm. But most of them are used as places which have some kind of gardening. They're not necessarily elaborate, but they're places that people have made where they go out and sit. Mm-hmm. You can't do much else; they're too small.
Yeah, so those are small because the ones we have here are much bigger. They're longer. They're narrow, but they're longer.
Well, these are narrow and short.
Yeah.
So they're about the size of this room.
We talked about Harvard and all the restaurants. I want to come back to that briefly and just talk about stores and commercial situations along Bloor and College, if you have any observations about those.
Less about College, because I don't know College that well. Mm-hmm. Bloor changed. When we first moved in, Bloor Street was a neighborhood shopping area. There were hardware stores. There's only one hardware. There were two hardware stores. There were clothing stores. It was kind of a mixed commercial area. And one by one, everything has become a sushi restaurant.
Plenty, yeah.
Yeah. So I had guests here a while back who were from the States I took them out for we were here for a conference. I took them out for sushi on Bloor Street, as a light meal, and they said, I mean, this is so good and this is so cheap. Where we come from, which was Rhode Island, they said, sushi if you want to have sushi, it's a big deal. It's like going to a fancy restaurant.
Boy, we can't relate to that. Both of us have lived near Bloor Street.
I know. So this must be the world's epicenter for inexpensive, good quality sushi.
You commented before about the security and the safety of the neighborhood.
Yeah.
Any changes in that? Have any thoughts about changes in, as far as that goes?
Any thoughts about changes?
In security and safety.
I didn't see a major change. I never felt insecure in this neighborhood. I do know that there have been the occasional incidents, but I don't see this as a high crime area. There was a period where people's cars were being broken into.
I see that.
But I think that kind of was like what they call a one person crime wave. It was that kind of situation. It was like one guy for whom this was his neighborhood beat, and once they caught him,
it stopped. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
The other thing is the other security issue has to do with drunkenness, which we don't see a lot in our street, but on College Street and on Bloor Street, it is a problem. And where we feel it on Robert Street, I don't know whether when you were on Robert, whether you had the experience, but there would be the occasional but regular event of people walking up the street on Friday night, or more typically Saturday night, smashing the rear view mirrors of cars.
I don't remember that when I was on Robert Street.
So that's just kind of drunken vandalism. It's an easy thing to do, to walk down the street and rip a car mirror off. Has that increased, decreased? I haven't noticed that for the past couple of years, but that is something. But that's our neighbor's house, our neighbor to the south, had their house was broken into.
A long time ago, or in the
recently,
last 2 years?
Yeah, there's this is the. My impression is that none of this is professional thievery. It's just, you know, crimes of opportunity by, you know, people who happen to be hanging around the neighborhood. We have not. Our house has never been broken into. We have an alarm system.
Which we
put on, and we put stickers on, and we lock up, and our house is not an easy target. So we've never had that kind of crime of opportunity. I do know that I have friends who, you know, who are true Canadians and grew up leaving their front doors unlocked, and who to this day say, you know, that's how I grew up, that's how I'm going to live. Right?
I grew up that way, and when I first came to Toronto, I lived that way, and now I walk the door. Were you around during the whole issue to do with the Spadina Expressway, or did you come
We came right after. We are the beneficiaries.
Uh-huh, right, yes, yes. What about Kensington Market? Do you use it? What do you feel is its effect on our community?
We have generally good feelings about Kensington Market. Mm-hmm. We don't go all the time, but we go regularly for fruits and vegetables. We go to the nuts for nuts and spices. Mm-hmm. We go clothes shopping in Spadina.
You mean in Kensington Market or
in Kensington
Spadina?
Market? Uh-huh. And, you know, it goes out all the. I just went this week. I needed the belt, and I knew exactly what I needed, and I needed a pair of sandals. So I was in a sports store, and I bought the sandals. But the belts were, what, I don't know, whatever they were, and I said, I'm not paying this, you know, I can get this for half price in Kensington Market. So the next time we were in Kensington Market Sunday, I got the belt I wanted for half price.
So you do use the market, and you like being close to it.
Yeah. And we also. Kensington Market has become a terrific vegetarian neighborhood. Oh. That, you know, right within the area around the market, there's half a dozen vegetarian restaurants.
King's Cafe, have you
been
there?
Yes, we like that. It's our favorite.
Yeah, we like it too. Yeah, just ate there last weekend. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's some other very nice ones.
Yeah. Yeah. So we eat there as well.
Yeah.
So in general, we're happy with the market. Tom from the clothing store is not happy with the market. He always says the market's in crisis, the landlords can't find tenants, but I don't know. But our experience, he's a businessman in the market. He sees problems, but we don't see it.
Well, certainly there are more cafes there.
Yeah.
That's a change. Mm-hmm. And it's bringing young people there.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
And we like the pedestrian Sundays. And there's the sense of excitement down there. Yeah.
I've gone to pedestrian Sunday many times, and I like it. And when I bring friends who don't live in the community, they want to walk through it quickly, and they're done with it. So I've learned I have to go with Paul or with friends from the neighborhood. But other people don't want to slow down and linger and just enjoy the atmosphere and the ambience. That's been my experience with it.
Mm-hmm.
What about the University of Toronto? How do you have some thoughts or feelings about how it impacts on us, liking it or whatever?
Oh, they're not good neighbors. What else can I say?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you wish they would have a more accommodating attitude towards the playing field at Robert Street. You know, the the most serious drawback of this neighborhood is that it's park deprived.
Yes. Yeah, we have just a little one here, yeah. Brunswick.
And the Robert Street playing field just sits there, you know, as green space that's walled. When we first came to the neighborhood, it wasn't walled off. The university, I understand why the university walled it off. They walled it off because of dogs.
Yes.
But, you know, it's an ugly chain link fence, and it keeps the neighbors, the kids who want to use the sports field, out. I don't want you to miss asking me about the Transact.
Well, please, because certainly towards the end of our meeting, yeah. I was going to ask, what have I not asked yeah. about that you want to talk about? Yeah. So let's go there.
Right. Okay. So the when I went back to guitar playing after my children grew up and I had time, I discovered the Transact, which I'd walked past and never gone in. There was a sign outside on the bulletin board saying, you know, folk music song circle, you know, last Tuesday of every month, you know, people welcome. So this must have been about 15 years ago. Maybe longer by now, I'm not sure. And that's also something that I really like about the neighborhood. I can just, once a month, I can just walk my guitar over to the Transact and spend 3 hours in a song circle with other people. And sometimes, but not usually, because it doesn't otherwise fit my schedule, I'll go to the jam they have on Saturday afternoons.
At the Transact.
It's an open music jam. So the Transact is very nice for amateur musicians. It's a nice part of the neighborhood. It's become a part of the neighborhood that I feel like I get my needs met within a 10-minute walk of my house. Almost everything I need. But it's kind of, you know, peculiar. Most people can't say that.
Transact also has the month or the 6 weeks before Christmas. Mm-hmm. They have a lot of different artists coming yeah. through and selling what they
yes.
make, and it's on a rotation basis. Mm-hmm. So if you go back 2 or 3 weeks in a row, you can meet some different artists selling mm-hmm. different
yeah.
you know, pieces of work.
Yeah, it's a nice little institution that. You know, it's one of these places that has a weird history. It was the Australian New Zealand Club, and they're no longer there. The Anzacs who founded it, you know, lost interest or moved away or whatever, and so they kind of left behind this building with a board of whoever was kind of interested. They had for years the Transact on Sunday night. Really good folk performances as well, very and on their stage. So, and every night of the week there's jazz or something. A lot of young performers. You know, it's a really nice arts venue.
I'll have to check it out. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so Stuart, is there anything else in addition to the Transact?
Mm-hmm.
That we didn't talk about, that when you knew you were coming, you were thinking, here are some things that would be interesting mm-hmm. for me to share, because you've lived here for so many years and mm-hmm. you've seen changes.
Yeah, I don't think so. I think as we wandered around from topic to topic,
yeah.
that, and some things I didn't think about talking, I didn't, you know, the story about Delane was not something I've thought about for a number of years, but, you know, you evoked it as we were talking about yeah. the neighborhood and changes.
Well, and as you said, it became a playground, an additional playground for the
yeah,
children.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. I play in this lane back here with my grandson.
Uh-huh.
Badminton, tennis, frisbee, baseball.
Oh, yeah.
We use it a lot. I love the lane. Yeah.
That's nice to hear, because I didn't know if our lane was unique in that way.
Oh, I think lanes are defined. I like back lane living.
Okay. Yeah. Are you getting that from other interviews?
People who lived here and went to school, they walked through, they mm-hmm. used the back lanes mm-hmm. for walking to school.
Right.
And one man described that they used it to kind of check their manhood and, you know, peeing on garages. But so there, yeah, the lanes have been used a lot by young people. And also I interviewed somebody who talked about, this is a woman, and she got her lane paved mm-hmm. because she would hang her laundry in and it came in dirty. So she got the neighbors and they paved the lane. So her laundry mm-hmm. came in clean after that. Mm-hmm. Well,
do you know Norman Track?
No, but I think I'd like to meet
yeah.
him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, maybe you'll help me meet him.
Sure. Yeah.
I look forward to that.
Okay. You know, Norman's very talkative.
Well, that's fine. Stuart, I just want to say thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, you're welcome.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
At this time, the recorder was turned off. Then it was turned on again a few minutes later for a few final remarks.
Okay, one more story
from Stuart. So here, Eliezer, is the story that I should have made a point to come with.
Yes.
Because this is something that I hope you'll be able to follow up. We have a friend whose name is Alan Robbins. Alan's an eccentric character. We see him sometimes. He showed up at our house one day, unannounced, saying, all excited, I had to come. Why did you have to come? He said, I was up north in Steeles Avenue. I had to deliver something at a woman's house, and she has a newspaper clipping from 1938 about her. She said, come, take a look. I'm reading. So here, I took a copy of the newspaper clipping. Take a look. So we read the newspaper clipping, and it's about a woman and her friend who hitchhiked from Toronto to New York to raise money for Habonim or something like that, for a Jewish charity. And it gave their addresses, 210 Robert Street. He said, this woman lived in your house in 1938. I had to show you this. So we called her up and we said, you know, we were very excited to know something about the history of our house, and we had a nice chat with her. And we said we'd like to have her come down. Of course, we never found the time to invite her to come down. But when I go home, I'll see if I can find that information and pass it on to you, and maybe you could interview her.
And I'm willing to drive. I've done some drives to meet people. Yes.
But such a, you know, and I guess everybody in this neighborhood has had the experience. Somebody knocks at your house and says, I used to live here. Can I come in?
Yeah, and you let them in.
Yeah.
I had a similar experience. I'm taking a politics class at Ryerson. And I was walking up the stairs with a man. We were heading into our class. Mm-hmm. And it turns out I had interviewed Rosie Schwartz. And it turns out that Rosie Schwartz bought the house from his family.
Mm-hmm.
So he lived there before Rosie.
Yeah.
And he's away during the summer, but I'm going to interview him at the end of the summer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we actually, the person who did that to our house was a couple owners back before us. I told you that our house had been first, we bought it from the doctor. The doctor bought it from somebody who done a partial renovation. And the person who had done the partial renovation had bought it from the Goldhar family. And it was the gold, and they were the ones who'd lived there for a long time. And they, it was someone from that family who knocked on our door and said, I'd like to come in.
Well, thank you, Stuart. I'm turning it off again. That's a terrific addition.